This is a Power 98.7 podcast. Now we're talking. Subscribe to Power 98.7 podcasts in iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. There's more on power987.co.za.
South Africa's aging water infrastructure is pushing the country away from reliable and safe water supplies. Of course, we've been talking about the aging infrastructure for years now. And of course, they're needing to deal with that, and why we haven't dealt with that. Those are other questions that, of course, sometimes are just left unanswered. With ongoing load shedding in place, reservoirs cannot, and we've seen this over the last couple of days, reservoirs cannot fill up fast enough. And to top it all, the country's water infrastructure needs urgent development as overall growth prospects also appear dim as we look at the country. So obviously also the energy crisis impacting the water supply, and then of course creating of what we've seen late, a little bit of a crisis within the water supply as well. My guest, of course, Chief Executive Officer at Mogalis Water, Sandile Psychology Mkize. I'm going to ask him about that second name, Psychology, and of course Professor Anthony Turton as well, water expert. Let's begin with you, Professor Anthony Turton. Welcome to Power Perspective. Welcome to Power 98.7.
Good evening to you, and even to your guest. I'm also interested in hearing about that second name.
So let's go straight there. Sandile Psychology Mkize. Let's talk about psychology. That is your second name, Psychology Mkize. So people call you Psychology, or they call you Sandile?
Good evening, Prof. Good evening to the Power 98.7 FM listeners. Most of the time, people call me Psychology. It depends where I am. In my hometown where I come from in KZN, they usually call me Psychology.
Okay.
Around in Gauteng, it's Sandile.
Okay, and psychology is in the ID book and on the passport and those kind of documents?
Definitely.
Okay. So Prof. Anthony Turton, there you've got it.
I'm born in KZN as well, and so my name is Kaoleza.
Kaoleza,
that's my traditional name here.
Go faster, Kaoleza. let's begin with you then, Prof. Anthony Turton. I'm going to put something. Is there consensus on the problems and what needs to be done around water supply, water security in this particular country? Consensus on the problem and what needs to be done about it. Is there consensus, or are we still deliberating on various levels about it?
Okay. Let me first start off by just saying that I refute the notion that aging infrastructure is a factor. I do not accept that. And the evidence for saying that is, let's just go and look at the city of Cologne, where my oldest relative, who came out of the Jan van Riebeck, who caused all the trouble for all of us, he came from the city of Cologne. And the city of Cologne in Germany...
Is that in Germany? Yes.
Cologne in Germany has been occupied continuously since the time of the Romans. And they've never, ever had anything like aging infrastructure. And yet the one church there, the Cologne Cathedral, took 850 years to build, believe it or not. Mm-hmm. And the city of London has been continuously occupied since the time of the Romans. And it's, they don't complain about aging infrastructure. Mm. Any of your major cities, New York City, you name anyone, Beijing, whatever, you name the city, they have been continuously occupied for hundreds of thousands of years. They're very much older than what we are. So infrastructure ages, and it automatically, as it ages, it is supposed to get phased out and replaced and upgraded. Mm. So the problem is not aging infrastructure. The problem is our inability to upgrade it and plan ahead and do the necessary procurement in time. That is our problem. And unfortunately, there is no consensus on that, because there's all kinds of excuses about, it's water scarcity, or it's this, or it's that, or it's load shedding. Those are all just excuses for actually not having done the proper strategic planning and the proper procurement a decade before it happens. That's how long these things take.
Let me ask you this, Prof. Are the two not particularly linked. So you could have aging infrastructure, as you say, not necessarily the problem, but you could have aging infrastructure, which is directly linked to what you say, the process of then phasing that out and upgrading. Because it's aging, you need to phase out and upgrade. So the two are intricately linked anyway. Wouldn't you say that?
Well, it's just continuous ongoing process. But
yes.
The thing is, because it's done properly, if it's done properly with a proper core of professional engineers that are properly well, adequately resourced, then the phasing isn't the problem. In fact, I've heard some of the biggest complaints about old infrastructure from the city of New York, believe it or not. Where people are complaining there about the fact that the sewage pumps are over 100 years old, and they're still working. They're still working. They keep them going. And some people say, well, they should be upgraded now, but they still keep them going. The point I want to make is that the age of the infrastructure per se is not a factor. Or things get old, and then they get either continuously maintained, or they get phased out. When I was doing my PhD in London, I was taken by the fact that I went to a lot of museums while I was there, while they were busy building a place that I was staying in Russell Square, they found some old wooden pipes. Believe it or not, pipes that had been made out of wood. And that goes back hundreds of years or so. Well, I wouldn't say thousands of years, but certainly hundreds of years that went back. And obviously it was leaking and obviously not in the best condition, but nonetheless, these things have been around for a long time. Mm. It comes down ultimately to the maintenance and the ability to forecast and to upgrade and to plan in time. That's what it comes down to, planning, procurement. That's what it is, nothing else.
Sure. So should I be more worried by what you've just said? Because obviously infrastructure has a lifespan, and that particular lifespan equipment will, for example, like you say, get old, and then the phasing out and the upgrading needs to happen. So if we are not doing all of that and we're just leaning on the crutch of equipment is old and we need to, you know, and that's the crutch that we're leaning on, what you're ultimately saying is we're failing in various aspects then. One is we're not planning, we're not forecasting, and we're not phasing out and we're not upgrading. And so that dynamic makes the scenario of, you know, when we talk about aging infrastructure, then it makes that whole dynamic quite a serious dynamic, because ultimately then we haven't done anything. Nothing would have then been done, because, like I said, planning, forecasting, phasing out, upgrading, zilch would have then been done. What we are then talking about is the old infrastructure, and yet we actually haven't implemented anything new, anything modern, anything practical that can accommodate the new time and the now.
Yes, you know, part of your planning is your forecasting for population growth. So all municipalities have got a thing by law called an IDP, an Integrated Development Plan. Mm. And in fact, the National Water Act, which was the first democratic legislation passed after our transition to democracy in 1994, the act was passed in 1997, 1998, if I remember correctly. Mm. But it was the first democratic act that came out. That's how important water is. But that calls for a thing called a National Water Resource Strategy, and that strategy has to reconcile demand and supply for water in the 19 water management areas. At that point in time, it's changed since then, but it had to basically develop a strategy to reconcile demand with supply. It had to link up with the integrated development plans, and it's all about planning. You must appreciate that you've got to do your planning a decade at least in advance, because that's how long it takes to finish the designs and to procure the material, because a lot of the stuff is long lead time procurement, etc. And of course, subsequent to that, what has happened is there's been a tremendous migration of people into the cities, into the big metropolitan areas. I heard numbers the other day which are quite mind-boggling, something like about 20% population increase over a decade. So that's a massive migration of people, and all of that has to be planned for, because ultimately, when you plan for your delivery of services in the water sector, you've got a thing called assurance of supply. And our systems are designed to what is known as a 98% assurance of supply. So that means that 98 times out of 100, you've got to have the water available. So you can have two breakdowns in 100 years or one breakdown in 50 years. That's what it comes down to.
Sure.
So we've got a very high assurance of supply. That's what the systems are designed for. And that requires an enormous amount of engineering skills and the ability to forecast. And now we get into details, and I mean, I don't want to confuddle the listeners with details, but when we became a democracy, there were all sorts of changes that were made to the architecture of power and the authority and control over water, and a lot of the authority was taken away from the Department of Water. What used to be the Department of Water and Forestry became the Department of Water and Sanitation eventually. A lot of the authority was taken away from there, and it was placed in municipalities that had never, ever had that authority before. And that was like in a moment of uhuru, if you like. You know, there was this fervor of democracy, and, you know, we now become this young democracy, and we were going to democratize the resource, and we were going to bring it close to the consumer. Which was an aspiration, an ideological aspiration, but it was very difficult to do. So that happened, and at the same time that happened, other decisions were made about linking your historically advantaged with your historically disadvantaged municipalities, the intention being very noble, and the noble intention was that the historically advantaged municipalities would lift up the historically disadvantaged. But in reality, in hindsight, what's now happened, if we look back with the 2020 vision of hindsight, the historically disadvantaged municipalities have brought down the historically advantaged. It hasn't worked the other way. So these are some of the factors. And then at the same time, we then had, on top of all of that mess now, we had this transformation imperative. And I'm not in any way arguing against transformation. Mm-hmm. We need transformation. There's no doubt about that. But there was a price to be paid for that, because that meant that we lost core skills at the very time when we didn't have the experience in the strategic planning department, at the very, very time when we were changing the architecture of decision-making and power and control, etc., at the very time when we applied this very, very sophisticated law called the National Water Act, that incidentally had in it this very sophisticated notion of what we call the reserve.
The reserve was
that's something we can talk about. That's a technical matter. But all of these things happened in this moment, in this absolute euphoria of the birth of this young democracy. And now we're finding that the implementation of those very noble ideas, every one of those ideas is a good idea. None of them are bad ideas. But how do we implement all of those things ultimately with a weakened human capacity? We haven't transferred the skills properly, etc. We haven't grown the institutions over time. And then into that mix now, we've had over time this ugly thing, corruption that's crept in. So that's kind of, it's a big bowl of spaghetti that I presented to you now. But that's the reason why we've got all these crises in the water and the energy sector, because what's happening in water is exactly what's happening in the energy sector for the same reasons.
Sure. Sandile. There's a lot to talk about.
Definitely. I can hear the prof. I'm taking the challenges that we are facing in water sector. Definitely.
Yeah. So there's a lot to talk about. Sandile, talk to some of the issues that the prof was talking about, lifespan and planning and forecasting, and particularly that element of aging infrastructure, not a problem. But he says the real reason there is we need to be talking about, you know, that aging infrastructure being phased out and the language that we should be using is upgrading of that particular instance. He talks about, you know, in some particular countries, in some cities, sewage pumps 100 years old, where ours would of course in a democratic South Africa more or less we'd be talking about 30 years old, but obviously, they'd be older because They weren't built in 1994. They were built way before that. So some of that infrastructure is much older than 1994. It would have just been in place in 1994. Talk to that. But I also then want to talk to you about your own experience in Mogale's water and what we should be learning from that and what kind of problems you're having in that particular space. So let's start with Professor Anthony Turton's comments and your comments in that regard, and then let's talk about your experiences.
I'm in agreement with Prof. I can tell you that we have been chasing new and emerging demand without paying much attention on the operation and maintenance of the existing infrastructure. So what happens is that when capital budget is made available, it tends to focus more on building new infrastructure. This is also linked to the current spatial planning, where you find that sometimes the planning, especially at a municipal level, is not regulated or regularized. You find that informal settlement pitch up one day, and it then develops and it has to be formalized, and then the infrastructure and services have to follow the new settlement. So even if you had developed a strategy and a plan, you find that with the kind of rapid urbanization that is taking place now, the current infrastructure is unable to cope with the rapid growth that is happening, and because of the funding gap between the infrastructure development, which is new infrastructure, and the operation and maintenance of the existing infrastructure, that's where you start to find problems happening in the system. The other thing that I can then differ with the prof is that when you look at these other countries, they are industrialized countries. For us, when we look at in South Africa, a simple water pump in South Africa is mostly imported, and those that are said to be manufactured in South Africa, it's only parts of those that are manufactured in South Africa, with other components being imported in the country. So I remember in 2001, when I was working for Department of Water and Sanitation, trying to deal with issues of pump station in Mfuleni that were breaking down. There were about 11 pump stations out of the 34 pump stations that were constantly breaking down. And as the manager who was responsible for the Klip River catchment then, we then tried to find out what is the problem. You'll find that some of the pumps were so old that there were not even spares in the country that could be used to fix those pumps. So the only thing that was needed was to remove those pumps and replace them with the new existing models that were there in the country.
It speaks to what Anthony is talking about, aging infrastructure being ultimately phased out and upgraded. That's the element, and not particularly fixed and tried to be repaired. It speaks to that particular element.
It's true, but with the industrialized countries, because these assets are manufactured in those countries, it's easy for them even to have spare parts for the equipment that they are running, such that they can be able to maintain and run it over 100 years. Some of this infrastructure, if it's taken care of, you will find that it will have more than 40-year lifespan, which is a standard lifespan of a water pump or a sewage pump.
Let's talk about Mogale's water. Just give us some insight into Mogale's water and what's going on there and how you're coping and the kind of problems that that you'd have on a day-to-day basis. Understanding the kind of things that we're going through at the moment, like load shedding, and you did say, there's a funding gap and the aspects of aging in infrastructure. Let's just give us some insight into Mogale's water.
Yeah, I think what the prof has talked about also is not unique only to the municipalities. Mm. Even the entities like our water board, which are state-owned entities,
mm.
you find that we do experience a challenge. Currently, we are experiencing a double whammy where we have the effects of climate change, which are upon us,
mm.
which causes long cycles of droughts
mm.
and flooding, which we are currently experiencing in South Africa.
Mm.
But also, in the area where I am, you find that where Makalis Water is based, especially in if we just look at the Northwest,
mm.
you find that because of the growth of the Northwest towns, especially mm. in Drakensberg,
mm.
the demand far outstrips the current supply that exists.
Mm.
From the master plan that Rustenburg local municipality did,
mm.
it shows that Rustenburg has a shortfall of about 100 megaliters a day
mm.
As a town. Yet, Rand Water is supplying more than 100 megaliters a day to Rustenburg.
Mm-hmm.
Makalik Water is supplying more than 40 megaliters a day. In fact, we are supplying through Rand Water Agreement about 80 megaliters a day to Rustenburg in one section. And we are supplying about 13 megaliters a day in other section.
Mm.
So you can see that there is quite a lot of amount of water just in one town, Rustenburg.
Mm.
But despite all that, there is still a shortage.
Mm.
What could be the cause of the shortage? Well, the time that it took for us to then come up with measures to deal with the demand,
mm.
it may have been long. This problem was identified, especially for Rustenburg, in 2009. Makalis mm. Water started with the bulk infrastructure master plan in 2014 to develop the master plan, and in 2015, we started rolling out and implementing the master plan. Had we developed that master plan in 2009 when the problem was identified
mm.
and rolled out the infrastructure, by this time, we will be saying that Rustenburg has no water issues. But currently,
mm.
even now, as I speak with you, where I am in the area of Kashan of Rustenburg,
mm.
we are having a water shedding where Rand Water, which is supplying this area,
mm.
has not enough water to be pumped into Kashan.
Mm.
So we are hoping that by 6 o'clock in the morning, one will start to get water in this area. So these are the challenges that you are getting.
Sandile,
it's not only unique in Rustenburg,
mm.
but also in other areas that you are supplying in Mafikeng, in Thaba Zimbi, in Modimolle, Mokopong,
mm.
in Limpopo. Yes. So these are the challenges that we are facing.
Sandile, before I go back to the prof, let me just ask you about that particular master plan. And you're talking about a period of what, 2008, 2009, and you're saying had we implemented at that particular time, Rustenburg would not have the kind of water shortages and the water problems that it's having at this particular moment. If we go back to that particular time, and this is within a democratic space, this is in the now. This is, you know, a government that ultimately is looking at, you know, very differently and various, you know, creative ways of getting water to the mass populace in this particular country. Why would that 2008 and 2009 particular master plan have fallen through the cracks? What's going on that when something needs to be done, it's not done? Or when something needs to be done, there's no funding for it, or there's just oversight and it's not seen as a priority? What's going on as to it's identified as something, there is a master plan that's drawn up, but then ultimately not implemented, and then we see the results of that so much later down the road? Why is that?
Yeah, maybe let me start by clarifying. The master plan is not 2008 and 2009. That's
mm.
when the problem was identified,
mm.
in 2008, 2009. Then there was a gap or a lag between the identification of a problem and the development of a master plan, which will then be aimed at addressing the solution.
Mm.
And now the master plan developed in 2014, and now in 2022-2023, we are starting to roll out the implementation of that part of the master plan mm. with capital infrastructure upgrade. Mm.
That's a long time, Sandile. That's a long, long journey. More than 10 years. That's 12, 13, 14 years.
It's true, but the major challenge is the capital funds availability. Mm. As you know, that water boards, water utilities, in terms of the PFMA, we are not getting any funding from the fiscal.
Mm.
So we have to raise funds through cost-reflective tariffs, and some of the funds that is surplus funds have to be invested for infrastructure upgrades.
Mm.
So for a water board like Makalis, it took a lot of time for us to generate so much surplus that that is now ready to be able to fund such a rollout of infrastructure. In fact, to be honest with you, had it not been for the infrastructure fund that was put in place by the president about 2 years ago.
Mm,
We were not going to be able to, to roll out this part of the infrastructure that are rolling out now. But with the infrastructure fund and the regional bulk infrastructure grant of the department, we are now able to get this infrastructure being rolled out, which will then help the communities of Rustenburg with the issues of water challenges or water shortages.
Wow, Sandile, I think you've just given us some massive insight into some of the problems. And like you say, had it not been for the funding that the president would have announced just two years ago, even those plans for Rustenburg would not have been in implementation. Professor Anthony Turton,
yes.
the issue of water demands that exceeds available raw water allocations. Are we particularly that country in general where water demands far exceed available raw water allocations? And we can get into a conversation about where the water goes and leakages and not using, you know, the various sort of water properly, you know, grey water and rainwater and storage and all of those elements. But are we in general a country where water demands exceed available raw water allocations?
I would almost say as a rule that, and I'm speaking now as the editor of the policy, of the journal called Water Policy, which is a journal for the World Water Council.
Yeah.
So I get a very, very good insight into what's happening in global trends. I'm responsible for the whole of Africa in my editorial role.
Mm.
So I can tell you without any fear of contradiction that demand almost always exceeds supply wherever you are, every geography.
Sure.
People want more than they can get. It's as simple as that.
Mm.
Now, if you just go back to what Mr. Mkhize said then about the you mentioned Rand Water. So let's just quickly home in onto Rand Water for a few seconds. Just to try and focus the listener now onto those few words. Oh, we get 100 megalitres a day from Rand Water or whatever the volume is.
Mm.
So just think about what I'm going to say now. So Rand Water gets its water from a multiple sources. So it gets water from the Lesotho Highlands.
Mm.
It gets water from the Tugela River in KZN. It's pumped up over the Drakensberg Mountains using surplus energy from the Eskom grid to eventually come to Sterkfontein Dam to be released down into the Vaal River, to then be taken out of the water at the Vaal River, and to then get processed and treated in Vereeniging, then get sent through a myriad of pipelines, massive 2-3 meter diameter pipelines that go all the way from Vereeniging all the way past the FNB Stadium near Soweto, and then that pipeline then swings across to Mogale City, And the pipeline that goes to Rustenburg actually branches off the pipeline from Mogale City to Randfontein at the old Westrand Consolidated Mine. It goes in front of a big mine dump known as I forget the name of the mine dump. It's a famous mine dump. Yeah, it goes in front of that mine dump. And it then swings out to Mogalesburg and eventually discharges the water in Rustenburg.
Rustenburg.
Just think of the distance. Think of the hundreds of kilometers of trenches that have been dug. These trenches take pipelines of 2 meter diameter pipelines. So you're talking about trenches that are 4 or 5 meters wide and deep. These are massive. This is a massive engineering undertaking. This is not a trivial matter at all. So you know this is engineering on a grand scale anyway. And what the listener might not know is that Rand Water, firstly, is the oldest institution in South Africa. There is no institution in South Africa older than Rand Water because it was created in 1903 at the end of the Anglo-Boer War, before South Africa was a country, before South Africa was South Africa. It was created, so it's older than South Africa as a country. And a second thing is that Rand Water is the biggest bulk supplier of water, not in South Africa, not in Africa, but in the world. It is the biggest single supplier of bulk water in the world. So this is, you know, we're talking here about world class engineering, world class institutions, famous places, literally famous. I mean, we've got bigger water boards in South Africa than you find in America, for example. So you know, that's just to get some context here. You know, we've got a deep history of very sophisticated engineering. To take a drop of water from the Lesotho Highlands, to take it through an 80 and 90 kilometer tunnel through the mountain into the Ash River outfall in the Liebenbergs flow, to eventually deliver that water to Mr. Mkhize, you know, where he is in Mogalesburg. That is a remarkable feat of engineering, and people might just think about that. It's remarkable. And the level of ingenuity, the level of sophistication that is taken for that simple act, when you open a tap in Rustenburg and water comes out, and you don't know that it came from, it came over the Drakensberg Mountain from Mutukela River. This is an amazing achievement of engineering.
So let me put it to you this way then, Prof. So we can talk about Rand Water and Rand Water proving itself most of the time, because, you know, if municipalities are ordering from Rand Water, Rand Water delivers that particular water, and it delivers that particular water with the kind of quality checks that it says it does, and it says it checks its water maybe on the hour, on every 2 hours. So it does that, and so Rand Water might be the largest bulk water distributor in the world. But the problem with Rand Water ultimately is, despite all of this technology with Rand Water, is water management falls under the ambit of local government and local municipalities. And that's where Rand Water cuts the line. Rand Water says to me and you and to the country that once I've delivered the water to that specific municipality, and I've delivered it absolutely in good quality and to the quantity that they want, I'm not responsible for leakages, quality, and distribution, and whatever after that. And that's where the problems begin to walk in. So we can give Rand Water all the kind of accolades that we want. Ultimately, the municipalities, as they are in this particular country, are not at top tier, and not to the best of what we want them to be. And that's ultimately the problem then with our water supply, is that it's not Rand Water that's with that kind of technology and that kind of skill and that kind of capacity that's giving us water. It's these failing municipalities.
Well, let's go one step beyond that, because you're entirely correct, but let's go one step beyond that now. Mr. Mkhize mentioned there the funding issues. I mean, the funding is always a complex thing. It's always, it's never an easy matter. But one central part of the funding problem that we have in South Africa is do people pay for water? Are they willing to pay for water? Is that money, the payment for water collected by the municipality, is it then paid over to Mogale's water? How much money is owed to Magalie's Water by delinquent municipalities? And does Magalie's Water pay what it owes to Rand Water? Because this is a universal problem. Rand Water has got debt like you cannot imagine, because major municipalities simply don't pay them. And because water is considered to be a human right, you can't cut off the flow. And that's exactly a mirror image of what's happening in Eskom. Municipalities owe Eskom billions and billions of rand. So therefore, Eskom's got a cash crisis. Well, exactly the same with Rand Water and Magalie's Water. People don't pay. But you can't cut off, because water is considered to be a human right. You are not allowed to simply go and cut off that water supply. You have to continue giving them that water. So ultimately, this is all wonderful. This is all political aspiration, and it's wonderful, and it's warm, fuzzy feeling stuff, okay? But the reality is it's unsustainable. It's simply financially unsustainable, unless it's cross-subsidized by something. And I say something, the only way you can cross-subsidize any of the stuff is somebody's got to pay for it somewhere. And you either pay for it by having a breakdown in the delivery. In other words, you pay for it by not having it. That's an opportunity cost. That's something that you haven't realized. Or somebody that's richer than you is paying for it, or some company somewhere, some industry is paying, the platinum industry is paying for it, or something like that. But somebody's got to pay for that. So water is an enormously complex thing. You just mentioned it now, very eloquent there now, the fact that that it doesn't just stop at the transition line where Rand Water delivers it into the bulk system now of Magalie's Water. There's a meter there at that point, and there's a transaction that takes place there.
Absolutely.
But the flow of money goes in the opposite direction to the flow of water. Now, water goes one way and money goes the other way, and those two things must balance each other out. And very often that doesn't happen. I think this is our culture of non-payment and our inability to collect money and to pay our bills. I think this is a universal problem in South Africa.
Sandile, I'm going to come to you. Sandile, let's talk about the collection of money. Somebody's got to pay for it. So Rand Water, you've ordered the water. Rand Water delivers it. And then, of course, you have it. And somebody's got to pay for it from that particular point onwards. And you were talking and you hinted at some of the funding models and some of the problems around funding of water and payment for water and infrastructure. But we were talking about infrastructure and how that deals with water. The paying for the water and the funding of that water and collection of that water. Talk to us about that particular element and the constraints and the frustrations.
Yes, Denzo. I think in South Africa we have a challenge with the culture of non-payment for the services rendered. You find that it's not only with the electricity, but also you find that in water, whereby the consumers do not pay for water that they are receiving from the local municipalities who are water services, or district municipalities who are water service authority, who have the role to reticulate. And then us as a bulk water service provider, with the value chain, you find that municipalities then don't pay us for the water that we have delivered. And I've seen in my interaction with communities that there's this understanding that water is a God-given a commodity that should not be charged.
Because it rains anyway, and so you're just collecting it and you're just distributing to us and you're asking money for it.
Definitely. Yes. The process of getting water from a raw source to the point where it is fit for human consumption involves a lot of engineering and science in it. So there are lots of chemical and treatment processes that need to be employed that are costly. The current nature of our raw water resources, for an example, where abstract water is... We abstract water, Magalie's Water, in the Crocodile West, where you have your Hartbeespoort sport dam. The quality of that water, to take that water from the clean state that is in to the point where you can put it in a glass and you see no color and you taste no notice that it's supposed to be there.
Mm.
It's a big process, and it's a costly process. So we have to charge water, and people need to be educated to say water is not just a God-given gift, but it is a process that it takes the water from the resource to you, and for you to get the water in your tap, it involves a lot of money. So you have to pay for the services that
Sandile, have been rendered to you. Sandile, let me ask you a practical question of which I don't know the answer, and which is which I'm hoping that you could particularly answer. Let's take Hartbeespoort Dam, and let's take Harties, for example. And when people start talking about, you know, Northwest and institutions and pumps failing and all of those things, and raw sewerage entering Harties, for example, right? And that's the element of that particular water, and all sorts of other chemicals entering that water space. That's, like you say, that becomes one of the entities from which you receive your water. Are we talking then of the treatment of all of those particular aspects of that water or in that water that ultimately lands up in a tap in somebody's yard, in somebody's house, that we have accepted that even it's not contaminated to the extent that it can't be treated, but we allow the sewerage, we allow all the chemicals to enter that particular space. We then engage in treatment of that particular water to an extent where it is drinkable and it's useful and we can use it. Is that the process that ultimately takes place? Because you know, when one sees sewerage entering a water a zone, one doesn't see the ultimate end of that particular journey that it's gone through. Is that something that particularly also happens, that you've got to treat that particularly kind of water to ultimately look like it's drinkable water at the end of that process?
That's correct, Denzel. What we do is that basically we take what is basically raw sewer, and we put it through a treatment process to the point where it is suitable for human consumption.
Mm.
First of all, the sewage systems, if they were operated in the country in the way they are supposed to be operated, we wouldn't be having the problems that we have.
Mm.
We have the laws that were put in place that were having a foresight of the situation that we may come to experience, which we are now currently experiencing, reducing the phosphate and the nitrate discharge into the water system.
Mm.
But without proper enforcement of those laws, we have seen that it's not only the quality now of the effluent, but we find that it's just the raw sewer bypassing all the wastewater treatment processes and going straight into the river.
Mm.
And that river becomes loaded with nutrients, and you find all types of bacteria and algae growing there. And then we have to then put measures in place to treat that water. As a result, when we look at Makalis water, we are not using a normal water purification processes that are applied mainly in the coastal areas. We have to have a pre-oxidation, pre-treatment, have a filtration with a dissolved flotation, and have... and also on the polishing stage through either granular activated carbon or powdered activated carbon at the end, and chlorination, so that the water that comes out, when it goes to the reservoir, it has a longer shelf life, and when it gets to the consumer, it is still fit for human consumption. Mm. So all these things, they cost money. So when you look at the cost per kiloliter in Makalis water, compared to municipalities or water boards that are in the coast, you'll find that the cost per kiloliter to treat for us is far more because of the the issue of the raw water that we deal with. For an example, a pure water is supposed to have what you call a treatability index of 1. When you look at the water that comes from RTPS sports there, at times you find that treatability index goes above 100, which means that it is more difficult to treat that water. Where 1 is pure water, it's what you call a spring or pristine water that is not contaminated, that you can take directly from the
from the source
and bottle it and use it. And then 100 is the water that you have to put certain measures in place to get it to the point where it is potable and fit for human consumption.
Sandile, let's end the conversation there. The next time I have a glass of water, Sandile, I'm going to just remember everything you've just said. And I'm going to hope that those purifying agencies and systems work, because ultimately, like you say, like you point out as well, raw sewage into our systems, and ultimately that's the water that we drink, but of course treated through the various systems. Sandile, psychology Mkize, thank you so much for coming on to Power Perspective tonight. Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Denzel.
Professor Anthony Turton, thank you so much for coming on to Power Perspective tonight. Thank you for sharing the ideas. Thank you for the information. And I don't think it's the last conversation that we've had. It's a topical conversation. So thank you so much for coming on to Power Perspective.
It's a pleasure as always, and thank you very much. And I wish Mr. Mkize all the best. He's got a very, very serious task on his hands there. We need to give our water boards all of our support from the public.
Professor Anthony Turnton, thank you so much.
You've been listening to a Power 98.7 podcast. For more podcasts, visit power987.co.za or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.